Welcome to the Filibuster, the podcast of the Union University Political Science Department. The Senate filibuster is the right to unlimited debate in the Senate. Due to the small size and small workload of the Senate, senators decided in the early 1800s that they did not need a means of limiting debate. Over the years, though, the Senate became larger and its workload greater. So finally, the Senate adopted a rule called Senate Rule 22 that allowed the Senate to invoke cloture and limit debate with a two-thirds majority vote. The instigating event for this change was a filibuster by anti-war senators in 1917, preventing Woodrow Wilson from pushing through a bill arming merchant marine vessels in the face of unrestricted German submarine warfare at the start of World War I. Unlike the Senate filibuster, however, we are going to place a limit on the length of our discussion, but we do hope to reflect the Senate ideal as the world's greatest deliberative body and be a forum of civil debate and discussion of major issues from our academic, political, and Christian perspectives. The topic of our podcast today is the 20th anniversary of 9/11 and the lessons and impacts that we have learned from that event. I'm Sean Evans. I'm chair of the department and professor of political science and host of the podcast. Today, I'm joined by my two colleagues, Hunter Baker, the dean of arts and science and professor of political science, and Greg Ryan, associate professor of international relations. All right, before we start talking about 9/11, let's briefly talk a little bit about President Biden's recent decision to pull out of Afghanistan and the evacuation process. Dr. Ryan, how would you assess President Biden's decision and handling of the withdrawal?
Well, I want to be consistent with past comments I've made on this. I've always thought that leaving Afghanistan would be difficult and messy for any U.S. president, and I assumed that when we left, things would quickly revert to, the pre-9/11 state. So I expected that. I do not think that leaving Afghanistan, at least getting out of some of the major nation-building aspects of it, is a bad decision. However, it seems that Biden or those that advise him really thought that this was a matter of fact operation, that it could be implemented without much thought. Biden seemed to focus on the embassy, and because of maintaining the embassy, he elevated the importance of Kabul Airport and probably denigrated the importance of Bagram Air Force Base. And I think this was a colossal mistake. Bagram Air Force Base is a place that we could have defended in depth and had much more familiarity with. And I think that was a huge mistake. I think he should have plussed up our numbers started to pull out people before, much earlier than the anticipated drawdown date. And also, it seems that there has been this assumption that collaboration with the Taliban was going to work out well. And I'm kind of scratching my head on that. So suffice it to say, it would have been difficult, no matter who the president was or which administration, but I think the implementation of this has been a fiasco.
Can I ask a question? So I know some people who are fairly sophisticated on this kind of stuff, and they make some contentions that I don't know whether they're true or not. Maybe you do, that make me wonder about how well or poorly we may have negotiated with the Taliban. For example, one of the contentions is that the Taliban offered to let the United States continue to control Kabul. Don't know if that's true or not.
I don't know if that's true or not either, but that certainly has not been the outcome.
No, right? Certainly not. All right.
And they weren't, as they moved through and captured towns in the wake of our withdrawal, they weren't pausing, okay? So, I mean, that tells us.
Okay, that makes sense. The other argument that our departure from Bagram was 100% voluntary.
Yeah, no, I think it was. I mean, it seems.
So why would we do that?
Well, it again, I think that the people who are making the decisions, and I don't necessarily think that's Joe Biden, assumed that this would be a simple matter of fact withdrawal, a non-combatant evacuation operation, that it would not be complex, and that the sooner the better, the quicker the better, and that not military necessity, but our diplomatic profile, i.e. the embassy, was most important. So you give up Bagram because you want to have something nearest the U.S. embassy. I think that was the thinking. I don't think it was informed thinking, but you see what I'm saying?
Okay.
The embassy was prioritized. We only want to have one place, as small a footprint for withdrawal as possible. So we keep the airport, which is near the embassy, and give up Bagram.
Okay. One more thing before I give way to the host. The other thing is, I just want to kind of bring in, let's call it the Monday morning quarterback view from Donald Trump, right, to see what you think about that.
Trump waited on this?
Trump has
what
waited.
What do you know?
It's so surprising, yes.
So my understanding, according to what Donald Trump has said, is that he would have gone about this differently. No surprise, since it's been a disaster.
Sure.
He says that he would have withdrawn the military last. That he would have, the first thing he would have done is get out everybody you want to get out, and then the military. Those are the last people to leave, as opposed to the kind of situation that we've had. What do you make of that?
Look, I understand that there is a contingent of opinion that just because Trump says it, it must be wrong, okay? But I think that is common sense.
Okay.
I think any operation, you're going to take the non-combatants out first, right, and leave combatants till the end, and they'll be withdrawn last. That's common sense.
But so this is one of the things that has bedeviled me, maybe as somebody who's an outsider to the foreign policy discussion, to a large part. I have tended to view these people, and I'm sure Dr. Evans would say the same. I think that often these are extraordinarily bright people. very accomplished.
Look, you have to understand where the country is today, okay? I mean, these people are promoted on the basis or put into positions on the basis of ideology.
Sure, but any regardless of where you are on the ideological spectrum, you don't want to come off looking incompetent. The question
you see the world differently.
How did we reach an incompetent sort of a result? Is the question I have.
Incompetent political people and incompetent military people. What do you tell the Taliban? I mean, I assume that we go to the 13 families that lost Marines, a sailor, and a soldier, and say, well, the Taliban just didn't get it. Because this is where we are. The people who said it's a good idea to get out, what the public opinion says, we don't want forever war, let's pull them out, assumed it would be a straightforward operation. It seems as if there were no lessons learned from past withdrawals, retrogrades, evacuations at all. They assumed it would be matter of fact.
I'm going to return to that point after we hear from the host, because there's something there.
Well, no, go.
Well, just so you talked about lessons learned from the past. One of the things that I have really thought about a lot as we've watched this unfold is I can remember when I was in college, I guess this would have been the earliest part of the 1990s, and we were preparing to embark upon the Gulf War, right, to try to basically restore the status quo after Iraq invaded Kuwait. And one of the things that I really remember is George H.W. Bush saying emphatically into the television, back when we all used to watch these kind of things, this will not be another Vietnam.
Right.
Right? You know, that was like the critical part of his message. And it seems as though, despite our great desire not to have that kind of an outcome, this one feels similar to me.
Well, the optics of the withdrawal.
Okay.
Right,
yes.
Were,
yes.
You know, the CH-47 Chinook.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, stuck in the memory of those who were
right
old enough at the time withdrawing from the, you know, well, hovering above the apartment building.
People falling off this giant aircraft, you know.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I just wonder at times if they could have managed this a little bit better. I know that President Biden thought that the military convinced Obama to do something he shouldn't have done. And so he was going to say, I'm taking them out. But it seemed to make more sense if you're going to withdraw the troops, you do it during the winter months
right.
when fighting doesn't occur,
yep.
Just so the optics are not there. If it does fall, it's not 1, 2, 3. There's a several-month delay because no one's fighting because it's too cold.
The Taliban operate on a baseball schedule. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this was this is still in high summer.
Okay. So let's kind of focus a little bit more on this as we wrap up. What are the international implications for President Biden's decision and withdrawal on how other nations, friend and foe, will view us now?
Well, it's more complex. People on the right will tend to say, you know, we're going to go back to Afghanistan being a safe haven for every terrorist group that wants to attack the West. Possibly, but I can't think the implications are great for the Chinese, right? They have attempted to woo and court the Taliban. The Chinese foreign minister, Wang Yi, had the titular head of the Taliban to China to wine him and dine him. Probably not wine him, I guess, since he's Taliban, but to try to get in the good graces. But the Taliban's hold on its constituent groups is very weak, particularly the Haqqani network, which has been blowing up Chinese roads and pipelines in Pakistan. And if you look at what the Chinese are doing to the Uyghurs, right, co-religionists of the Taliban and Afghanistan's proximity to Xinjiang, where the Uyghurs are, and China's plans for the Belt and Road Project that run through Central Asia, this could cause a lot of problems for them, too.
Right. Okay, well, what do you think about the people who rely on expected utility theory to where they're saying a foreign leader will make decisions based in part on what they anticipate the United States and Joe Biden will do.
Sure.
Does this make them think, okay, Joe Biden's not going to be a forceful response, in which case it may potentially encourage some nations to take actions they otherwise would not?
It's possible, and certainly it's been talked about with relation to Taiwan, with relation to Ukraine. I think they thought Biden was weak before this, and this may have confirmed that belief. So I think it's possible, and maybe even likely under some circumstances. I just want to reiterate that it's probably incorrect to assume that renewed Islamic terrorist activity will only be aimed at the West and the United States.
Right. You know, it's one thing that's interesting in this is that as I think about reactions, I do wonder if the Taliban would have acted differently with a President Donald Trump, just because you don't know what he would do, right? I mean, if
but by the same token, Donald Trump was the one who wanted to pull out even before he left office.
That's
and
true.
He was the one that made the deal with the Taliban.
That is all true.
To get out. So I mean,
but
I'm,
my but
I'm
my
not
question
sure
is
be all that different.
My question is, would they have given him his space? Right? Would they have?
And there were contingencies in the deal.
Yeah, right? I'm kind of wondering if they would have been more accommodating to the American withdrawal, given the fact that Donald Trump could turn on a dime and go crazy on you, right? I mean, that's
it's like Nixon's madman theory.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, one final thing about the international implications. I know a lot of the people in Europe and our allies around the world were somewhat hopeful that a President Biden would be different than a President Trump. But yet, from all the chatter I hear out of Europe, there are a lot of allies who are upset that there was no communication, uh-huh. there was no working with the allies on a plan of withdrawal, and they're saying, is Biden really any different from Trump, and does this mean we have to start planning on making decisions without the U.S. in mind?
Well, personally, I think Biden is very different from Trump, but I won't go down that road, but I would say that in his almost total absence of consultation, it was very messy. We have this kind of report that, over 2 days, Boris Johnson was trying to get in contact with Biden, and he just wouldn't answer him. And again, we're back to an earlier conversation about withdrawing civilians, non-combatants, before the military. It seems that there should have been a consultation across the various Western and other military forces in Afghanistan to get all of their people out.
The coalition of the willing.
Right. Coalition of the – well, it was it was bigger than that. This yeah. was, that was more relevant to Iraq.
Yeah.
But it – and that there would have been a plan, a joint or an allied military operation for the final retrograde. Hmm. Right.
Okay. Well, let's now turn to 9/11. I know that there's this big thing in pop culture. People always ask, where were you when this happened? So, I mean, let's just start off. Where were you when you first heard about what was going on 9/11? I'll kind of start off here. I was actually driving onto campus that morning. I was making
Union's campus.
Yes, on Union's campus. I came in there next to Starbucks past Hammond's Hall when I was listening to the radio and turning there toward to go down toward the circle and on down past the Panic Building when they talked about a plane had hit into the first tower and they just thought it was a commuter plane. So I said, oh, well, this wasn't that big of a deal. I went to my office. I was prepping for my classes. I walked out to go to my next class. I ran into another faculty member who was about to cry, and I'm like, what's going on? And the faculty member said, don't you know what happened? And I said, well, what? And then that's when I was told that a second plane had hit and that they were jet airliners. I went down to my class and we watched TV for the next hour and a half or so. And so that's kind of my first memories of that. Hunter, what about you?
Well, I remember very clearly. I was a lobbyist for a conservative group in Atlanta, Georgia, and I started off the morning driving to the Department of Education on some business, and I heard the same report you did mm-hmm. about a commuter plane, or some small plane. Didn't think much of it, and by the time I left the Department of Education, they were talking about that actually a full-size jet plane had hit the building. I was then driving further north to our headquarters, and was told that a second plane had hit. A friend called me and told me a second plane had hit. And I think I arrived at our headquarters. Everybody was, as you would expect, everybody is glued to the television. And I remember seeing those buildings start to come down. And that was utterly shocking, right? I mean, the World Trade Center coming down like that. And at that time, I had a thought which proved not to be very prescient, which was I thought the United States is going to be under martial law. I mean, I thought that there would be very severe ramifications. The reality is that airline travel became somewhat more unpleasant. But that's about it, yeah. Right? I remember not long after that going on a trip to St. Martin in the Caribbean and seeing for the first time armed men with M16s in the airport. So I recall that. And going to a meeting in the House of Representatives not long after that as well, and a very palpable feeling of danger. You wondered if there might yet be something to happen.
So this was in D.C., not
this was in D.C.
Not the Georgia legislature.
And the other thing I remember is I will never forget it. Driving, I drove out past the Pentagon to go to my hotel, and this was the beginning of when you started to have these GPS type things in a rental car. And I was kind of fooling with that and looking down and trying to get it straight. And I looked up, and there was the Pentagon smashed. Right? I'm never going to forget what it was like to look up and see the Pentagon absolutely smashed. Mm-hmm. It was just as an American, you know, not having been through the kind of things that Europeans had been through or Japanese or whoever else during World War II, it was utterly shocking to see something like that. And that's stayed with me ever since.
All right. Greg?
I was in Knoxville. It was when I was a graduate, you know, studies at University of Tennessee, UTK. It was a Tuesday. Is that right? What day of the week?
I don't remember.
9/11.
It was either on a Monday, Wednesday, Friday because – no, hold it. Yeah, because it was a 9:25 class I was going to. So, yeah, a Tuesday or Thursday.
I'm thinking it was a Tuesday, and I don't remember what my class schedule was. I was got up in my apartment in very humble graduate student apartment circumstances. And didn't have the TV on, probably had the radio on, but hadn't heard anything. And I got a call from a friend of mine, Ben Stewart. He goes, "You better turn on your TV." So I turned it on, and I think that was after I probably got up later than you all. I probably don't find that hard to believe. And I think the first, you know, they had confirmed that it was, a large civilian airliner that had hit the first tower. And this is probably right before the second tower was hit. I stayed and watched. And then I went to campus, of course, and everybody was – it was a very – you know, UT is a huge campus, right? But it was just a very silent day. There were people everywhere, but they were whispering. They were gathering in front of TVs. Classes didn't – they might have met, but they didn't really have class. And certainly there was a sense that – we were in a new era, right? I mean, it was a watershed. And I can remember having a lot of conversations with people about what would the reaction be. And I knew some people who said, well, there shouldn't be a military response, and others who were for an overwhelming military response, and who did it, and who's to blame. So there was a lot of confusion.
Yeah.
Okay, so Hunter's already mentioned some memories that stand out on that day and afterward. Are there other things that stand out with you about that day or certain memories?
Well, personally, I knew it might change my life because I had wanted to go into the military and because of slight injuries had not, and I thought, well, there probably are going to be a lot more slots opening up now, right? I mean, so there was, and turned out to be the case, right? Especially for, intelligence officers, because there was a strong sense that if you're going to fight a war against terrorism, which this developed into, it may be more about knowledge than about mass concentration of forces, right? So on a personal note, I mean, I wondered what the implications personally would be for me, and it turned out that there were implications.
Right. Well, I think partly about what I remember about 9/11 is the response of the American people, the institutions, and everything else about how tragic a day it was, but also how we rose together as one in the response to that. And things just as simple as you turned on the TV, every single channel was showing the news coverage, and people weren't really complaining about that. I mean, the idea that the passengers on Flight 93 hearing what went on and saying, let's roll, let's make sure this plane does not hit and cause damage, that sticks in my mind. I still remember Bush's bullhorn moment a couple of days after 9/11, when he went from the contested president to the president of the United States with his hand around that fireman talking. Someone says, I can't hear you. And he said, but I can hear you, and the rest of the world hears you, and the people who knocked down these buildings down will hear all of us soon. With that, and of course, on the afternoon of 9/11, our divided Congress getting together, singing God Bless America, a time that we have not seen much of since, and I think we all would wish we could see a little bit more unity in that respect. So what...
Well, I just wanted to say, you mentioned Flight 93, which had kind of slipped my mind. There's a very impressive film made, not the one that was made for TV, the one that was cinematic release, Flight 93. I think the director is Paul Greenglass. But I remember seeing that movie, and it was so, it felt so real, the recreation of events. And I remember when that movie finished, how incredibly intense it felt. The passengers trying to stop that plane and bring it down. And after that movie was over, it was as if I was at a cemetery. It was a full theater, and it literally felt like someone had died. You know, so the intent. It's so strange to be an American in that sense, because we can have these moments where we feel totally unified and we have something in common. But then, you know, after a period of time, it just wears off and we kind of go back to, fighting.
Right. Back to normal as far as it goes. Well, let's kind of change direction here and say, what have been the lessons and the impact of 9/11? It, of course, 9/11 led to the U.S. military going into Afghanistan, eventually into Iraq. It led to the Patriot Act, to detention. I mean, we're still dealing with what do we do with those who are holding Gitmo. So, what do you see as, let's just start off with the three major lessons or impacts. We'll kind of go with each. We'll start with you, Greg.
I had five lessons. Is that okay?
Sure.
Our impacts.
Let's go with the five.
I think it led to, you know, less freedom. And, you know, one of the things that I've come to be aware of associated with that was there was major potential congressional action on limiting big tech right before, you know, in the summer of 2001. That completely went away because of the intelligence importance. It was assumed, and not incorrectly so, that big tech would be a major ally in locating and fixing terrorists, right? So that got big tech off the hook. But with the Patriot Act and other things, I think it led to less freedom. A tremendous amount of, you know, not just traditional defense, but many other areas which are indirectly related to defense, spending, and creation of whole new departments like the Homeland Security, and, you know, which would broadly fall under what we would, Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex.
Well, I guess we could even include that to include Homeland Security,
sure,
to where it's not just a military, it's kind of it's a security complex.
Sure.
I mean, in which case, it's not just our relations with others, but also what's going on here.
And
I think that was largely negative. we can see benefits. Both of you are from North Alabama. The war on terror was really good to North Alabama.
I think that's true. No, I think it was good for Huntsville. My father, not just the war on terror, but my father went to work on missile defense stuff in North Alabama immediately in that period.
So areas of the country that have defense interest bases, whatever, benefited.
Yeah.
So that would be the second one. Third, I think there was a lower emphasis on traditional threats, which became somewhat pathological. The military focus on strike against insurgents and counterinsurgency displaced other more traditional concerns and peer competitor concerns. Mm-hmm. And I think we will suffer for that, particularly Russia and China. Maybe I just had four. And the fourth one, it put us really back into this incredible kind of dynamic of believing we could create stable democratic societies in areas of the world which did not really have, let's say, the accommodating soil of for democracy. And, you know, that's one of the fallouts we're seeing in Afghanistan. There's just such a temptation there, almost a self-absorption, a self-idolatry, to try to rebuild, you know, in a way that mimics our own experience. And, you know, this is the incredible conceit of a place like Afghanistan or Iraq, to think in 5 years or 10 years or 15 years or 20 years, we're going to put in place a system which can overcome the inertia of several thousand years of societal experience in those areas. So those are the four, I would say. Less freedom, much more defense spending, misplaced defense priorities, and massive abortive attempts at nation building. I see those as the four impacts.
All right. Hunter.
Okay. The first thing I would say, I have often reflected on this, is that so when 9/11 happened, I can remember George W. Bush said, "This is now the focus of my presidency." And I think that people forget that he came in as this governor from Texas, not with a foreign policy focus at all, right? I mean, in fact, part of the reason he had to choose Dick Cheney as his running mate, you know, as vice president, was to provide the foreign policy gravitas, you know, to add weight. He provided nothing electorally, but he, which turned out to be needed.
Who came straight from Halliburton, from which he got a $36 million severance package.
But he told Lieberman that he deserved that, so you need to just accept his word. Okay. So his focus was public policy and domestic public policy, really. And I have often reflected on what was lost in that, because I think that there was actually some good public policy beginning to kind of rise to the fore. Some of it through the Clinton administration in combination with Republicans in Congress. I'm thinking about the welfare reform. I'm thinking about increasing openness to things like school choice and charitable choice, sort of religious nonprofits doing good, things like that. Within the world of public administration, there was this whole movement around a book called Reinventing Government,
right?
That, you know, that was kind of beginning to have benign effects, I think, within people's thinking about government and how to be more cost effective and more effective in pursuing the mission.
Fiscal responsibility.
Fiscal responsibility. All of that got lost, right? I mean, all of that stuff just kind of went to the wayside with the focus on terrorism. And I guess we have forgotten that briefly there we were having some of the better fiscal performance that we've ever had, you know, certainly in the post-World War II period.
Yes, thanks to that tech bubble
exactly.
of the 1990s. Yes.
Lots of
certainly
capital
helped.
Gains. Some
yes.
tremendous capital yes. gains came in. That's right. And, you know, and actually, Greg, so it's after 9/11 that we get that terrible tech bust in the stock market. In fact, stock market really did not recover. Really did not recover until after the financial crisis. That, you know, you didn't start to kind of really see the gains. Just to underwrite what Dr. Ryan said about modernization and democracy, we learned that Afghanistan and Iraq are not Germany, South Korea, and Japan. That it's just not the same thing. I have a colleague at Georgetown who would sit here and tell you all day that democratic constitutionalism or liberal democracy is just an app. And anybody can download that app and it'll work out fine. And to me, I think we've seen the counterfactual.
Right.
I think it is not just an app, and I think it matters what the history is before, and I think that things like the Reformation and the Renaissance and these things matter, you know, the American Revolution, the French Revolution, I think it matters. So I think that has been discredited even though he's still pushing that thesis. And I think that one of the side effects is that neoconservatism had become a pretty strong political movement on the American right, to the point where National Review, through the pen of David Frum, basically wrote a lot of people out of the conservative movement, you know, or at least the acceptable conservative movement during that time, people like Pat Buchanan and others, over their reluctance with regard to Afghanistan and Iraq. So it had a big effect on the Republican Party and the American right.
Right. I mean, there are plenty of people who think that Donald Trump would not have arisen if it was not for the war, the spending to get us out of the 2008 recession with TARP and other kinds of things. Yeah.
I'm one of those people.
Yeah. Okay, so there's a couple of other lessons that I think we've learned that. That we've learned, or I think we need to learn. The first one is the importance of accountability. So I look at it more turning to the Iraq situation, that there was a consensus in the international and the domestic intelligence community that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, and he did not. And people kept their jobs after that. And I think when you have a major disaster on something like that, you need to make sure heads roll, not just in the sense, well, yes, in the sense to where there's an importance of responsibility that needs to be incentivized. And you're basically telling people that, okay, you can say something, it's wrong, and you're going to get away with it. Haven't we seen the problem of that over the past 20 years? Think about all we've been told about Afghanistan, about how, oh, the military leaders go in, we're doing this, we're the Afghan army is better than ever before. And yet what we are finding is that wasn't the case. And in many cases, the people knew it, but yet they told their superiors in the first place what they wanted to hear. And I think that goes not just to competence, but to ethics. I recently read Yuval Levin's A Time to Build, and so part of his critique is that the reason people don't trust institutions is because our institutions don't form people like they used to. I think that's part of it. I think competence also plays a big role. But part of what he was saying is we move from that noblesse oblige to a more meritocratic type elites where they think they have earned their position to be in that place, but yet they are separated from that ethic. And so part of it is that, one, they don't think they can be wrong, and two, it's difficult for them to admit they're wrong because they're the best and the brightest, so to speak.
Yeah. This speaks to your competence, assumed competence.
That's right.
You know, question, which you brought up in the early on.
Yeah. So you're right, it builds right with that. And I guess closely related to that is the importance of humility, which and the ability to admit I may be wrong, and it could be that I made mistakes and I need to correct them. I think Pericles said, "What I fear is not the enemy's strategy, but our own mistakes." And I think it is our own mistakes that have got us into the problems we have, which makes it more difficult to self-correct. I mean, I look on some level at the Bush administration. They set into motion that study about what do we need to do in Iraq in 2006 before the elections, and then after the election, then we admit we made mistakes, we get rid of Rumsfeld, we'll go in a different direction. Well, it was clear, I think, to everybody that the Iraqi situation was not what we were being told. And so I think there has to be that certain humility to say we make mistakes, and that continued with Obama, with Trump, and now with Biden, to where I'm even for Biden, it may be the right decision to get out, but you totally failed in the withdrawal. I saw something where 22% of people approve of his withdrawal in Afghanistan, 71% disapprove. So everyone knows it, but the people in charge they know it, they're just not willing to admit it. And I think that's a major problem in and of itself. I'll throw in this, which gets to Greg's idea about the loss of freedom. I look at it as the importance of rigorous oversight by the executive branch on the courts and the executive branch. Specifically, the legislature needs to focus on the executive branch. So whether it was intention, whether it was the detention of suspected terrorists, the interrogation process, the oversight of drone attacks, which happened once we pulled out of Iraq, or more of it, oversight of the effectiveness in Iraq and Afghanistan, Congress has not lived up to its expectations in this regard. We used to talk a little bit more about norms in Congress back in the mid-20th century, when there was an establishment that ruled the Senate, the House, and the government overall, a much different kind of establishment than we have today. One of those norms was the importance of institutional loyalty, to where you were willing to put the prerogatives and powers of the institution over your own good and over your own party's good. And I think what we have seen, unfortunately, with both parties is that we're going to defend our side no matter what, even if we may think it's incorrect, and we will forego our oversight and other responsibilities because it's worse if we attack our team, or not attack a team. If we hold our team responsible for mistakes, it may cost us electorally, but yet by not holding our team responsible, it cost us electorally. I think it somewhat affects our souls in the way to where we're not willing to admit mistakes. We're not willing to hold people accountable. We promote a certain amount of hypocrisy, which is a cancer that is affecting our nation at large. I think I might throw another one in, and I've got maybe some others, but I'll go with this, and then we'll see if others want to throw in. Is I think the response to 9/11, where the nation came together, we had an overwhelming vote for the war in Iraq, which in retrospect, many regret. We passed the Patriot Act with overwhelming numbers. We came together. That we have this idea that the only way we can get things done is if there's a crisis. Crisis will allow us to come together and to get things done. And so what that has led us to do is try to make everything into a crisis, thinking that that is the only way for the Congress and the president to get together and to act. And I think we've lost a certain amount of perspective because we want to do everything at once, and it means we cannot distinguish between a crisis and a serious problem. A crisis, you may need a immediate response, and it may need to be comprehensive. If it's a serious problem, it's a complex one. It takes time, and it's going to require incremental change, see how this works, and continue to focus on that. And I think that has lessened our legislative muscles. I mean, yeah, I'm someone who's a legislative scholar, so I may be a little bit partial to Congress, but I think both parties are allowing the president to do more than he should and more than we should allow the president to do, because it means we are not having the discussions that we need as a nation to resolve our problems, and it leads to unilateral ideological action when what we really need is to persuade people to get out of our box and try to promote a little bit more bipartisan leadership. So I'll turn into that and make that my last point, I guess, is the importance of bipartisan leadership. We had that at 9/11. And for all the complaints of George Bush, and they're there, President Obama, or then Senator Obama, criticized him, but he kept the infrastructure. So there was a large degree of consensus with that, on into the Trump administration and on into the Biden administration on some levels. Of course, as we have pointed out, sometimes that consensus does not work out. But that's also because we weren't really having the conversations. I think people on the right and the left brought up good points about, should we really reconsider the authorization for the use of military force so that we force leaders to engage in the issues and discuss it and continue to build support or maintain support among the American public, which also, once again, helps us reach out. We can't just talk to our side. We have to talk to everybody, and it's going to help us move forward, at least see that we have more in common, and put a greater focus on, yeah, there are some things we have to compromise and work together on or find common ground, however you want to do it. And I think the way that we have gone in terms of unilateral and ideological policymaking has not been good for the nation.
You know, given that you are somebody who studies Congress, maybe you can respond. I have heard it argued, and I think you can probably confirm or disconfirm this, that Congress has ceded a large amount of its authority to the executive branch.
Yes. I mean, part of it, they have done it through law, but part of it is because we're so ideological, we're not willing to make the compromises. So one party, when they control the White House, they want their party to make unilateral decision because that way they can get what they want when they really can't. Remember, if you use executive action, it's temporary.
True. Right.
It can be repealed by the next president, as President Trump has found out. Many of the things he has done has been reversed, as President Obama learned when Trump reversed a lot of that, and when whoever replaces President Biden will learn that can be replaced.
But
legislation is always better than executive action.
Well, and here's the other important thing, right, is that if we think about the constitutional design, much of which we have worked to defeat through, you know, the court and legislation and activism, but if you think about the constitutional design, Congress is actually supposed to be the prime mover, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that is the structure of the Constitution. Go ahead.
This makes me think about not our Constitution, but comparisons that have been made both now and historically with parliamentary or majoritarian systems, in which I think about the Suez Crisis of 1956, which ended the French Fourth Republic and brought down Anthony Eden's conservative government. This was assigning responsibility, and at times maybe the government's not brought down, but cabinet officers would resign. Uh-huh. The other thing, you know, that is obvious, tremendous context for the last 20 years is the changing media environment. Yep. The changing media environment really, we think about, certainly the Senate as being a deliberative body. Well, the speed of and pervasiveness of communication has killed space for deliberation,
right,
and emphasized, again, the center. So these circumstances have militated against our finding solutions to
yeah.
take power or to restrain executive action.
Well,
and
well,
policy.
Yeah, and to underline what I'm saying about Congress is that not only is Congress supposed to be kind of the prime mover in all of this, okay, with its House and its Senate, and the protections that those convey and the way those channel the passions of the people, but also checks and balances, right? The
mm-hmm.
division of power,
right,
between the executive and the House and the Senate, and that this is done for good reason. And so to the extent that we work too hard to defeat that design, you know, we can more easily make mistakes.
Right. Well, and that's the thing with saying we should expand the court or we should get rid of the filibuster and all this. Instead of trying to work with the system, we're trying to make changes to deal with the problems that are caused by us not working the way the system was designed.
Yeah.
But the other thing I would say, again, it goes back to one of my points in talking about the impact of 9/11 today. The growth of private power and its relationship with the bureaucracy
mm-hmm.
has had a tremendous crowding effect against the ability to push back. For anybody.
But not just the bureaucracy, right? There are so many ways we can think about this, but one thing that kind of freaks me out is the degree to which people from political positions end up in the media.
Well, sure.
Right? I mean.
Yeah. But in the military.
Yeah.
Anybody above colonel will retire, and who do they go work for?
A defense contractor.
Yeah. Right. And yeah. that, you know, this is something that has polluted the system.
Yeah. Okay. So our time is just about here. Any last comments before we close things up?
I'll just say, I think that looking at Afghanistan, we just see a painful lesson. I mean, one of the lessons throughout history is that trying to control what happens in a foreign land far away from home rarely works out well. And I think a lot of us, including me, after Iraq and Afghanistan, had limitless confidence in the singular nation we call the United States of America to impose its will and to have its way. And that has proved to be far more difficult than people like my 32-year-old self thought it was.
And that's why I will continually encourage you to read The Best and the Brightest. If you had read The Best and the Brightest
right.
before, you would not have been so easily caught up in that.
I think I was avoiding Vietnam because it was also a bad thing. Yeah.
Well, then let me end with this, and I'm going to go back to something that Greg said, that he knew he was interested in joining the military and that he knew that it would have consequences for him if we were going to war. So I think Hunter, myself, our listeners, and everyone else would like to say thank you, Greg, for your service to our nation.
Well,
because you and many others were willing to give the ultimate sacrifice to protect our nation. So thank you for that.
I'll just say that, yes, I was removed most of the time from any danger, or all of the time. I was around people who were in danger. And I feel like they were in a position, and some of them did, have to make much greater sacrifices than I. So I'm thankful for the way it turned out for me.
All right. And with that, we thank you for listening, and I yield back the balance of my time.